This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Scotland Outdoors Podcast from BBC Radio Scotland.
Goodness, isn't it?
You know,
ow! Sorry. This is my knee.
Yeah, we were complaining about a lack of signage at the bottom. Perhaps should have been a sign saying not suitable for bikes. That's why the gate wasn't suitable.
Possibly. And the back of my right leg is now red raw where I've been bouncing the pedal off it, because you can't possibly cycle up this. Maybe somebody could. Maybe somebody superhuman.
Proper cyclist,
but not us. And the left leg is chewed up with the gorse. So, aside from that, I'm fine. I'm enjoying myself thoroughly.
You've still got a failed way to go. Yeah. And it's, what, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the afternoon?
Oh,
see, already we're putting jeopardy in.
Yeah, look on the bright side. Look on the bright side. We'll be eaten by wolves.
Somebody accused us of putting on fake, out-of-breath sound effect.
We know it's steep. You don't need to pretend to be out of breath. Yeah, it's us. We're pretending. Honest.
Whoa. Stuck.
Yeah. It's not stuck, it's gravity.
Oh. Oh.
You know, we started whinging this morning about that the one thing St. Cuthbert was famous for was being able to change the direction of the wind, and it is now behind us.
Thank you, St. Cuthbert.
There's a story of him at Coldingham going and praying out up to his neck in the water, and then the story goes that when he comes out of the sea in the morning, the otters come and breathe on his feet to dry them, and then they rub against him to dry them.
How do you feel? I got a first aid certificate.
Are you in long?
No, I'm long.
Hello, and a very warm welcome to a very special edition of Out of Doors. This week, Ewan and I are doing something kind of odd for a pair of old sinners. We're going on a pilgrimage.
Yeah, we're following St Cuthbert's Way, or as close as we can manage by bike, and we're setting off today from Melrose Abbey on one shiny pink bike, well, one slightly tatty pink bike, and one tatty white bike.
Yeah, the whole idea of pilgrimage is a fascinating one, and obviously because we start off from here and go up and over the Eildon Hills, essentially we've got the mortification of the flesh right, you know, that's sorted. The rest of it we're not terribly sure of. We've got a distance of about 62 miles to cover, but in the tradition of really silly television programmes, we've got a deadline, because we have to hit it by a certain point when we get to this farm, otherwise the tide will be wrong and we won't get onto Holy Island.
And it could be the highest tide in living memory.
We could die.
But along the way, we'll be visiting some of the places closely associated with St Cuthbert, the first of which is here at Melrose by the River Tweed. And we're starting off this, we're going to raise our hands in perfect honesty, we know very, very little about St Cuthbert, but that's why we're here.
We have a man who does. We've come to the back of Melrose Abbey, and it is a beautiful old building. I mean, the windows are still intact, there's no roof. You know, post-Reformation, this place just fell to pieces, essentially, or was pushed to pieces, more accurately. Dr. Donald Smith is the director of the Scottish Storytelling Centre in Edinburgh, and he's written information on 6 pilgrimage trails round about Scotland. Let's begin with the beginning. What is pilgrimage? How do you define pilgrimage?
Well, I think pilgrimage is a journey you make with a certain intention. So in traditional times, people were keen to reach the special shrine or place associated with a holy man or woman. I think nowadays it's more in the journey. people are just journeying with an idea, maybe of a wee bit of reflection, maybe thinking back on their own memories and past life and thinking forward. So it's a kind of journey with a little bit of reflection, but that doesn't rule out enjoyment, fun, and a bit of storytelling along the way.
So there is a spiritual side to it still, but perhaps not religious.
That's right, I think, or not religious perhaps in the same traditional way, although it's also, I think, important to say that traditional pilgrimage is also on the upsurge, but then it's being added to by all these contemporary pilgrims. And going on Cuthbert's journey, I mean, you can go all the way down beyond Lindisfarne to Durham, where Cuthbert was buried, and the things he was buried with are still there to be seen. So history is a way of sticking with us.
I find it fascinating that pilgrimage still is on the go. I mean, I have several friends, for example, have done the pilgrimage trail to Santiago de Compostela. They're not churchy. You know, they don't adhere to any particular faith, and yet it's something they really wanted to do.
I think that's right. And, I mean, part of it comes out also in this Cuthbert journey is that a lot of these routes, particularly in Scotland, and then, we're going into lovely Northumbria as well, take you to very beautiful places. So Cuthbert was somebody who was very keen on seeking simplicity and peace and being close to the natural world. And I think that's what people are looking for still on these journeys. And the whole idea of taking the time to walk or to cycle or whatever it is that you're to be unhurried, even if you do get drowned at the end.
Thank you for that.
But you could do that anywhere. I mean, well, why the significance?
I mean, Mark and I could walk off that hill and have that whole spiritual experience in any direction. It's like that you have to have some reason, and that pilgrimage gives you that almost that justification.
I think that's where the traditional stories come in. So you're heading off in this Cuthbert journey, and you're absolutely following routes and places that are associated with this very, very appealing guy. You know, he's born and raised as a shepherd up here in the Leader Valley. He's a soldier at one point. And there's this amazing story how this night up in the hills, he sees this radiant vision of light in the night sky. And then he learns that Aidan, St. Aidan, who was the great founder of Lindisfarne, has died that very night. And that just gives him an impulse that he should come here to Melrose and join the monastery. And I think there's something in the gentleness and the passion and the peacefulness and the closeness to the natural world and to God in Cuthbert's story that gives that little extra bit of resonance. And you are following in his steps.
I'm getting quite excited, aren't you?
I'm getting there. We're going to head off because we've been warned by Trish, one of our listeners on the borders, there's a long series of steps that have to be negotiated before we go anywhere. So we'll see.
And the hills used to be one hill, isn't it? There are three now, but they weren't always three.
Well, Michael Scott, the wizard, now he's another favourite character around here as the man who's supposed to have got the devil to split them in three, you know. So he's another figure of the borders lore, you know, in the storytelling.
You see, if Michael Scott had any sense, he would have put a gentle path.
A gentle
path. Yeah, he could have put a word in.
Now that's a wizard, it'd be summies.
Thanks a lot.
But you never know who you might meet today. Magical, inspiring, or terrifying.
That was a bad start to the first leg. It's a brutal start to any cycle or walk. You come straight out of Melrose at about a 45, 50 degree angle.
It's not quite as bad as that felt like it.
Well, we are following the cycle route now. We've come up through the golf course, and as I say, it's marked as a cycle route. And what do we get? It's a kissing gate.
A kissing gate.
We've decided not.
Right, you're safe. Don't worry.
Well, we didn't have the option because we had to climb over it, carrying the bikes.
Yeah. Oh, what's that up there? A couple of ravens.
Yeah, I think you're right. But we are out of town at last, and suddenly it's peaceful, it's quiet.
Yeah. We're just heading up to the saddle between the, you know, two of the sort of three Eildon Hills here. But now we've got through the Kissing Gate, the path gets seriously stony and steep. Uh-huh. So we'll see.
You couldn't help feeling it. When he carved that saddle up there, could have made it a wee bit shallower.
A wee bit of tunnel. Right. I mean, tunnelling, that's, I mean, we're not looking for magic, we're looking for a tunnel.
Proper wizard would have put a tunnel in there.
Proper wizard.
here we are, finally at the top, and a choice of four or five paths to go on. Hi there.
Hello.
Which way is the St Cuthbert's Way going to St Botherwell?
I've got a little map, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Have you? It's quite punishing, isn't it?
It's worse than we thought.
Yeah. Do you want to carry a bike?
Carry back down?
No.
Back down's okay.
Just come that way, just going back home.
Okay, which way have you come up?
We've come up from Melrose.
Okay.
And then we've been up to Rymer Stone up here.
Great.
We're going back down.
Either of you pair got a first aid certificate?
Hanging long.
Hanging long.
Oh, thank you. Kind of flattened out for that last section, but for a while there I was thinking, this is going to be the death of me. It's worth it though. You come up, we're right on the saddle. So you've got Melrose behind us and just this vast array of presumably a bit of Scotland and then England.
Behind us, just slightly further down, you're getting a good view of the Abbey, but it also made it crystal clear that after a life or death struggle up the hill, we'd covered about a mile, with 61 miles to go.
It is stunningly beautiful. It just opens up. You've got this whole tapestry, a kind of patchwork, a quilt work almost of fields, and this really thing that rams at home. And the amount of trees that are bordering the field, suddenly you've got proper hedges, and you've got, because we come from a land where hedges are few and far between.
Quite. Now, this is a very, very fertile landscape, and obviously, you know, this was the stamping ground of the Ettrick shepherd, James Hogg. And I was casting about to find something appropriate that he'd written, and this is from his poem, Caledonia. Sweet land of the bay and wild winding deeps, where loveliness slumbers at even, while far in the depth of the blue water sleeps a calm little motionless heaven. Now land of the valley, the moor and the hill, of the storm and the proud rolling wave, yes, thou art the land of fair liberty still, and the land of my forefather's grave.
I like this.
This is lovely, isn't it?
It's like going down. There's two hedgerows and they're forming a tunnel coming down off the Oldens. And you're going down through hawthorn berries and rose hips and brambles and, you know, elderberries. It's beautiful.
It's stunning. Suddenly you're like, I don't know if you imagine an English lane.
Look at, I was about to say, it just reminds me of England.
Uh-huh. Oh, it's not far away. It's a wren just sitting in the rose hips there. It's beautiful.
Wee Jenny Wren. No, I mean, it's coming down off the Eildons. I mean, it was a bit of a slog pushing the bikes up. Slightly adventurous coming down in places, I'd have to say.
Aye, because it's proper rocky track.
You've been doing a road bike.
How bad it was, I immediately put my helmet on. And then you get on this grassy path, just at the light.
Yeah.
If you're going to fall, this is the place to do it.
It's like a bridle way.
What is the one downside about all this?
What?
Because we're not quite sure we're on the right track.
No, permanently lost, that's it.
We're hopeful. Right, Chedbur at last.
Yep, and it's a fair up and down, I must confess. Came down off the Eildon Hills and that was quite nice, very pleasant. Got to Newton's and Boswell's. Then we followed the track part of the way down and we took the old Roman road, the Deer Road, but to be honest, it's not good for bikes. It really isn't good for bikes, is it?
We started the day at an abbey, and we finished the day at an abbey, and there's a reason for that.
Ah, well, basically, what I want to do is find out more about St Cuthbert, and unless I'm mistaken, are you Helen? Hi, how are you doing?
Hello, how are you?
Mark Stephen. Sorry to keep you waiting, that's very kind. This is Ewan.
Hi Helen.
Hi, nice to meet you.
How did you recognise us?
Because I said to look for two cyclists.
Yes.
She's being polite. I said two middle-aged guys on bikes.
Two middle-aged guys that shouldn't be anywhere near cycling gear.
My name is Dr. Helen Foxhall Forbes. I'm a lecturer in early medieval history at Durham University.
So you're the person to speak to about St Cuthbert?
Yes, St Cuthbert was a local to this area. He was from Lauderdale originally, and so he entered the monastery at Melrose, what's now Old Melrose, just a bit to the east of the modern town, in 651 when he was 15 years old. He went to Ripon for a bit in Yorkshire, and at some point he was asked to be Bishop of Lindisfarne, which was a very important site, but, you know, it's on an island.
It's a bit of a dead end, isn't it?
It's a bit out of the way, exactly. And that was the point, that people could be a bit removed from the secular world.
In the 7th century, the concept of a north-south border, would that have made any sense at all?
Not in the sense that we have it now. So there was no Scotland, there was no England. There were a series of different kingdoms that were much smaller than the political units that we have now. So Jedburgh was part of the Anglo-Saxon kingdom of Northumbria, and in Cuthbert's time that extended all the way up to the Forth, and it extended down as far as the Humber.
Well, what about St Cuthbert? I mean, well, why are we here all those hundreds of years later? What was so special about him? I mean, since arguably ten a penny at that time, medieval times. So what was so special about him? What were the qualities?
I think he was a bit of a hardliner on some things, but he was also presented, certainly in the later sources, as a very caring bishop who looked after his congregation. So he was somebody who was prepared to uphold the rule on the one hand, but also deeply concerned about individuals and individuals' salvation.
Here we are, the end of day one, but the story, the feeling we're getting so far is very much a man of the countryside, a man of the landscape, and then wildlife and countryside were really important to him.
He was a shepherd, we're told, to start with. He lived in the wilderness when he was a hermit. There are various miracles involving animals, like otters, who came and kind of rolled at his feet. Mm. Animals will bring him things, and this is presented as part of his kind of holiness. And so he's got a kind of closeness with the natural world. He's sort of attuned to the natural world, that it's part of his being.
After he died, another sign, supposedly, of his holiness.
There were lots of signs of his holiness after he died. There were lots of miracles, and this is one of the things that makes him a saint. And Bede records that he said that he didn't want to be buried on Lindisfarne because the brothers there would have all sorts of people coming to his tomb to seek sanctuary. Mm-hmm. But there were a number of miracles. There was a boy who, this is in the anonymous life, the Lindisfarne writer tells us that there was a boy who was healed by being put in Cuthbert's shoes, which is a sort of interesting idea of how you can take something that's been very close to somebody holy and it retains the essence of the person.
Was he not exhumed at one stage?
He was exhumed as well, and they found that his body was incorrupt. And they actually checked this again in the 19th century and supposedly found that it also was still incorrupt, yeah.
You do wonder, you hear about this happening with quite a few saints, and you assume, well, obviously it's some form of natural mummification, it's something to do with the sores they put in, etc. And yeah, it's ghoulish, but you'd like to see it.
It is ghoulish, yeah, and it's one of those things that's very difficult to, when we see it in the sources, it's very difficult to know what do they mean. They tell us that he looked as if he was just asleep, that his body hadn't dried out at all, you could still move all the limbs, and it's very difficult to know how far we should trust this. But as I say, work in the 19th century suggested that he certainly hadn't turned into a skeleton.
How does he relate time-wise to the Lindisfarne Gospels?
Now, that's interesting. He's earlier than the Lindisfarne Gospels. Cuthbert died in 687.
But I'm waiting for a but.
But the Lindisfarne Gospels may have been produced as part of the early stages of celebrating the cult of Cuthbert. Okay. So there's possibly written and maybe drawn to by Bishop Eadfrith of Lindisfarne, who lived in the early part of the 8th century. And it seems, as it's been suggested, that one of the reasons that the Lindisfarne Gospels might have been created was to sit on the sanctuary where St Cuthbert was buried as a sort of monument to him.
Now, well, we're heading to Lindisfarne.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But he's not there anymore, is he?
He's in Durham Cathedral.
Well, how did that happen?
Well, in 793...
Nothing to do with the university,
there honest. There he is lying, not decomposing.
No, Durham has ended up with both Cuthbert and Bede.
So
what happened... In 793, the Vikings raided Lindisfarne, and this was the beginning of a series of assaults. And the monks in Lindisfarne, the community of St Cuthbert, decided that they couldn't stay in Lindisfarne anymore. So they began this long and quite complicated peregrination round, central Britain. And on the way back, we're told that there was a miracle. When they were approaching Durham, the peninsula where the cathedral is, the cart stopped and it wouldn't go any further. And they took this as a sign that that's where they should stop. That's where Cuthbert wanted to stay. It would have been unthinkable to abandon him. They wouldn't have been the community of St Cuthbert without taking him with them. And so he ended up in the cathedral in Durham because they founded a new community. And so in that sense, Durham Cathedral is the descendant of Lindisfarne.
Thank you. And the Age of Miracles is not dead, for these bikes have stopped in front, low, in front of this very pub, and will go no further.
And a chip shop.
Quite early in the morning, it's breakfast time on day two in the St Cuthbert's Way, and as I was sitting having breakfast in the hotel in Jedburgh, got into conversation with Callum Murray here, who curiously enough is from Aberdeen, and you're doing the St Cuthbert's Way. You've done bits of it before.
Yeah, that's right. We're doing the South St Cuthbert's Way this year. We've done the Borders Abbey Way 2 years ago.
You've done lots of long-distance routes, though.
Yeah, we've done quite a few over the years. West Highland Way, obviously the most famous of them all. Great Glen Way, East Highland Way, Speyside Way.
How many times have you done the West Highland Way?
11 times now. Hoping to make it 12 next year.
That's 10 too many. Am I? Do you know what I find? It's a wee bit passé, and this is a bit more, you know, St Cuthbert's Way. It's kind of more grown up. It's a little bit more of an elite walk.
I think it is. It's certainly quieter. There's fewer walkers, but you're all walking at the same average pace each day, so you tend to get in a trail, just following each other. But it is much quieter, but the scenery is entirely different from the West Highland Way.
This is only the second day for us, and already we have come to the conclusion that we've made a huge tactical error bringing bikes.
I would think you probably have. It's a lot of hard rock on the path. It looks so good on the map, but the reality is slightly different. Yeah. Hard going.
Even something like, you know, the old Roman Road, Deer Street, yesterday, I mean, you know, it looks, it's sloping gently downhill, it's ideal, and it's a dead straight line, but about every 100 metres, 150 metres, there's stiles, there's gates, or something of the kind, it drives you nuts.
So, where are you going today?
We're off, it's a long day for us, it's 20 miles, and we're going to Kirkyetham today, and then on to Wooler, Fenwick, and then Holy Island. So we should be there on Friday afternoon, hopefully.
There's a limited amount of places that we can actually follow the trail directly. But effectively, we're heading to Wooler today. It's 34 miles, so it's going to be a bit of a trudge.
40 miles in my map.
Is it? Yeah, it's always longer in your map, for some reason.
I'm sure you'll get there in the end.
Wouldn't bet it. Practically the first thing we said when we left the hotel in Jedburgh this morning was, oh, it's a bit of a nip in the air this morning. Well, we're not feeling the cold anymore.
No, I knew it was a bad start when you go downhill for a couple of hundred yards. Well, you're disagreeing. I think it was at least 2 miles straight up. Absolutely incredible.
Yeah, we climbed up about 500 feet and now we've come across the other side and it is just stunning. There are clouds in the sky and what we're looking across basically is the Cheviots. And it's a back road, and when we were coming down that bridle path yesterday, we both said, this is a bit like England. Well, this is a bit like England. There's high hedges on either side of the road, but the views immediately in front of us are stunning.
A long cycle today, but it's really, really, really glorious, which is a blessing. In fact, and we're going downhill now, which is a big improvement.
We were talking in the hotel that we've probably made a tactical mistake taking the bikes, and on the way up that hill, I was having a bit of a mental readjustment. I was thinking, okay, fair enough. We're not actually on the St Cuthbert's Way for a lot of this, because we can't, not with bikes. It's just too much effort. But it wasn't the route that St Cuthbert took anyway. And what we're doing is we're going from Melrose, and we're going to end up in Lindisfarne. Okay, we're doing it a different way. It's still a pilgrimage.
Well, this might have been the way it went.
By bicycle. By medieval bicycle.
Kind of common consensus is you might well have actually gone down the river.
See if we could find a way of going down the river. You know, something with a shallow draft, like a raft, I'd be up for that.
But this is glorious. I mean,
a heron in there. You hear it? As we came over the brow of the hill there, it suddenly got a lot quieter.
I suppose that's the joy of the Borders. You got deep valleys that just block all the sign, because you're right, within half a mile you're in a different world.
Yeah, really golden, you know, and everything's on the turn, you know, there's thistle down on the thistles, there's, you know, that sort of fluffy stuff that you get in rosemary willow herb, you know, all the leaves are starting to change colour, everything's starting to die back for the winter, and we've got a buzzard. We're just trying to do a sort of a St Cuthbert thing. just stop and listen to the bird song round about us.
There is a wren or a robin in the background. I've just seen a sparrowhawk.
Yeah.
Just kind of that, almost like a spitfire rolling over the hedge and down, you know, just inches above the hedge.
Yeah. No, that, no, they're spectacular animals. It's a great view from here. And before we set off on this trail, I was doing some research into St. Cuthbert. And during his last months at Old Melrose, Boisil was Cuthbert's friend and teacher. He knew he was dying of the plague, and as he was dying, he read to Cuthbert from a commentary of John's Gospel, and it kind of informed and guided the path of Cuthbert for the rest of his life. So much so that Cuthbert was actually buried with a copy of John's Gospel by his side. I came across this nice quotation, and it applies to us because we've been lost more times than we actually knew where we were going. Can we trust other people's maps, or should we follow our own paths and find out for ourselves, make our unaided choices? Perhaps the choice is unreal. We have to follow well-worn routes to discover what might be personal, a fresh point of departure. This is so close to our road. I wanted to stop and look at this. It's a keep. And it dates back to the time, it's a Cessford castle, it dates back to the time of the Border Reavers, etc. 15th century. You see how massive the walls are, L-shaped, I mean, absolutely defensive. You know, because folk coming from down south would come and raid here, they would go and raid down south. It was a continuous process. If you knew that basically a war party was coming, everybody ran in there and hid.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the, kind of the frontier forts, isn't it? It's just, you could almost draw parallels with the frontier forts in India. Like, it's got that kind of feel about it. And also similar red sandstone.
Well, the great thing about this place is it was owned by the Kerrs, K-E-R, single R. And the Kerrs were renowned for being left-handed. And it produced a local expression to be Kerry pawed. Now, have you heard the phrase Corry fisted?
Right.
I wonder if the two things are actually connected. There are thereabouts.
The things you learn in the middle of nowhere. Now you're scaring me. But looking away across to the south, you've got real rolling hills of England. It is just beautiful.
Yeah.
It's just because you get a real sense of height up here.
Yeah.
Don't we know it?
But look at that. It's almost as if there's a whole pile of objects under there and someone has draped green velvet across the whole top. It's beautiful.
Yeah, and somewhere down there should be Holy Island, but very, very pleasant. And a great cycle. We were moaning earlier on, but changed days now.
Oh, yeah. No, this is the business. We are actually on here, a section of the St. Cuthbert's Way. But as I said earlier, who cares? It's just a great part of the countryside to be going through.
By way of contrast, we've come off the peace and tranquility of the hills and we've come into a beautiful wee village that I didn't know existed, I must admit.
More battle. It's got nothing to do with battles, apparently. It is from an old word, mere bottle, lake dwelling. And apparently there was a loch here once upon a time, Linton Loch. It was big and all.
Yeah, this is the border village on the Lost Loch. It was actually covered here at one point.
Yeah. They found beaver remains about 6,000 years old and freshwater snail remains, you know, sort of marl. So it's really pretty. It's a bonny wee place.
I'm not pretending I knew this. I'm reading this off an information board in the middle of the village. But Robert Dawson, 1778, he was a ploughman poet, parallel to Burns, and he wrote about the lives of the rural poor. He's buried in the churchyard here. But I mean, it's fantastic names. You've got Howman Law, Gubbet Law.
Gubbet Law's great, isn't it?
Wide open hill.
Yeah. Closed in hill.
Yeah.
Crooked Shaw's hill. And there's a legend here of the Linton Worm, a mythical serpent or dragon which ravages the countryside. So William Somerville potted it eventually using his spear tipped with burning tar. I'll do it every time.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is real frontier stuff, isn't it? I mean, it's idyllic, it's peaceful, but this must have been a hell of a place to live. I mean, just right in the middle of the battles between the north and the south.
This is the intersection point between the end of the Pennine Way and the St. Cuthbert's Way. And we've met up here with local historian Tom Tokley. This is Kirk Yetham. Now, Kirk Yetham, to my mind, is famous, or Yetham generally, is famous for gypsies. Why? What's the connection?
Well, it was the Battle of Namur in 1695 in Belgium. The local there had to take so many men to fight, and they went to the Battle of Namur with this group, and in amongst them, of course, there were some gypsies that had come to the village, and he fought there, and he got badly injured. But this young lad carried him back, saved his life, and his name was a Young. And he said, I'll build you some houses on that side of the street, which is called Michael's Row. And they settled in the village. This became the gypsy village, Kirkcaterham.
See, I find this very odd, because to my mind, gypsies travel. Gypsies move about, they don't settle.
They stayed in the houses during the winter and then went away in the spring. That was their life. You couldn't change that. And there was a minister came, and he tried to save them, taking their children with them. And he tried to get people in the village that would take the children during the summer and they would get them to go to school. He was desperate to have them educated. But some of the children would stay. And there was a time they had about 16 of the children stayed in the village, and the villagers looked after them during the summer, and they went to school. He was keen to have them educated.
Did he destroy that tradition? I mean, that's maybe an exaggeration, but in so many cases, was that the start of the end?
Well, you could say that was the start of the end, because that was them breaking up their tradition of travelling all the time. I mean, a lot of the gypsies, they worked on farms. They had to live some way. They went to get rabbits and out of the hills, out of the farms, because that's how they lived, with rabbits and pheasants, anything they could poach. They were good poachers, and they always had dogs with them. These were always the things that you saw gypsies with. They had their ponies, but they always had dogs, and they would go and catch a rabbit or a hare.
Crossing a really nice wee bridge here, and just as we cross the bridge, we pass from Scotland into England in the Northumberland National Park. You feel any different?
Not terribly different, but it's amazing that you suddenly cross a wee border like that, and suddenly you're into a very different outdoor world.
Well, obviously in Scotland we've got the Land Reform Act, and that gives us, you know, basically responsible right of access anywhere, which doesn't exist here. You know, you can't wild camp, you can't do all sorts of things.
Yeah, I was reading the guidebook, because it does say, actually, when you step over the border, please be aware that you can no longer wild camp. You know, you can camp in that field, you can't camp in this one.
Yeah. Now, we've left Yetham, and basically we're just cycling along the bottom of a long valley here. We've left the St Cuthbert's Way behind, we're making our own way to Wooler. This is actually just perfect. It's perfect cycling.
It is ideal. I mean, basically, the St Cuthbert's Way goes over the hill, some serious climbing. We've opted for the sensible option today to actually do what we were told. Yeah. And it is a delightful cycle.
Yeah.
Oh, look at that tractor.
Vintage Case tractor. Isn't that a stunner? I like the look of that.
And you've got a couple of belted galloways there. Beautiful animals. Well, he's got a horse, a couple of a Hereford. Uh-huh. And a couple of Oracoos and two ugly Texel sheep.
No, there's another four over there. He's got six ugly Texel sheep. For those people out there who breed Texel sheep, we're not going to apologise. Let's face it, they are ugly.
I'll tell you what, a very rare event. A car
has flooded past.
Because we've been cycling for hours now, and almost no vehicles at all.
Yeah. When we left Jedburgh this morning, I mean, it was that ferocious climb out of Jedburgh. And then you go up and down and up and down and up and down, you know, and you do get to the stage of actually dreading a downhill, because you think, well, there's got to be something on the other side of this. But then we hit a bigger road, and there were white lines painted in the centre, and I really resented that.
Yeah.
There was a car.
And another one. Yeah. It's just getting out of hand.
That's a trailer too. It's just ridiculous, like being on a motorway. This is the third and final day of the St Cuthbert's Way. We stopped at Wooler last night, and I told you that idea leaving the bikes outside wouldn't work. They're still here.
Sadly, nobody wanted to steal two cheap bikes, but the wind's got up, the temperature's dropped. It's not raining.
It's not raining, but you know, I came out first thing this morning, And you know, yesterday with the wind immediately behind us, which was fab, today it's going to be blowing straight in our face as we head due north and then hang a right heading for Lindisfarne.
You know what we should have had was St Cuthbert. I was reading about him last night. Aye. And he was really, really, really good at getting the wind to change direction. He had a couple of miracles when there was wood coming into the monastery and the wind was blowing the boats offshore, they threatened to be wrecked, and he turned it round and blew them back in again. And a couple of times he changed it so they could benefit his people. So we could do with that today.
That's a great story. Did they give instructions in the book?
Well, it says, and I quite like to see it, but essentially he got down on his knees, he put his head to the ground, and instantly the wind changed direction. I don't think it's going to happen.
But going to happen for us.
A lot of highlights today. We've got St Cuthbert's Cave, which I'm
looking forward to.
Should be good. Apparently, yeah. It's really good. And then the island itself.
I've been to it once before with friends. But we drove on, and this feels completely different. You know, actually coming at it across land, you know, and having to put in the physical effort of cycling and what have you. So I am looking forward to it.
And potentially getting wet.
Possibly. Aye. If we take the pilgrimage route, if we walk across the sands, if we manage to time it right with the tide, that's going to take about 2 hours. Just coming up to really one of the high points on the walk, St Cuthbert's Cave, and I don't know what I expected, but I didn't expect this. There's a stand, a plantation of Scots pine on the slopes of the ridge, and you walk through the pine and all of a sudden it opens out almost a natural amphitheatre, and then up the far end there is the cave proper. And I mean, you described it quite well. It's a bit like Hollywood.
What is it? It's like Disneyland as you come in, and it does look slightly fiberglassy.
I mean, it's not. It's not. I mean, we're here with Ron Shaw, the creator of the St Cuthbert's Way. I mean, that's sandstone.
That is fell sandstone, yes.
So which, you're glaring at me as if I'm accusing you of fiberglass.
Fell sandstone, which is, I don't know if it's peculiar to Northumberland, but we've got two ridges that run through the county of this stone. It's a great building stone as well.
Because we were told this is a must-see and it's an important part of it. Wow, I mean, this is, it just looks so alien to the environment.
It's an extraordinary place. What makes this St Cuthbert's Cave?
Because, legend, basically, when the monks had to leave Lindisfarne after repeated Viking raids, legend has it that the first night on dry land was spent here in the St Cuthbert's Cave shelter.
We're just coming up to the cave itself. I mean, you can hear the fact that the acoustics are actually changing. It's actually quite shallow. I don't know about you, this always makes me kind of nervous. There is one proper stone, not much bigger than a man. And then above us, a couple of hundred tons of rock. Yeah. Just because it stayed up there for eternity doesn't mean it's going to keep on.
Because this whole thing is probably about 120 feet long. It goes in about, 20 feet or so,
yeah.
And there's just this one wee pillar holding it up, which is quite scary.
You described it quite well earlier. You said it was more like a car porch than a cave, and, you know, and there's an element of truth in that. There's lots of graffiti too. It goes back to 1847.
Yes, they go back to 17-something, I think, is the earliest one.
But no sign of St Cuthbert's followers leaving traces here?
Well, at certain times of the year, you will find crosses all along here. Uh-huh.
Tell you what I notice here, because if you imagine the roof shelving out and there are big rocks, which were probably part of the roof once upon a time, you know, it's collapsed and they've rolled slightly downhill. The top of that looks like the top of a pumpkin.
Mm-hmm.
And it's where the water has been running off the shelf and hitting the top of that stone and carving grooves out of it. And you see the same thing across there with that one, the vertical grooves there.
Yes, it's fantastic. It really is very much a feature of fell sandstone and other sandstones as well. These grooves that you get from it, from the water and other forms of erosion. Yeah.
It's not often you get the chance to talk to the person who actually set up a long-distance walking route, who came up with the idea in the first place. But where did the idea come from?
I've always had an interest in Anglo-Saxon Northumbria, you know, when it stretched from the Humber to the Firth of Forth, and the story of St Cuthbert's very much part of that. And I was fortunate to be made project officer of the Till Valley Tourism Initiative. The idea was to develop sustainable tourism in the area, which stretched from the Border Ridge to the Kyler Ridge, where we are now, and from the Breamish Valley, which is the southernmost part, valley in this side of the Cheviots, up to the Tweed. And the first winter ploughing through my maps and saw that basically with St Cuthbert's story originating in Melrose and finishing on Lindisfarne, if I joined the two together, somehow we could bring Wooler into a long-distance footpath. So I penciled it in on this large-scale South Scotland map, actually, and got in touch with Roger Smith, who'd recently been appointed Walking Development Officer for Scottish Borders. I told him what I had in mind, and he thought it had some potential. So we then went to our lords and masters, 10 of them in total, and said what we...
10 different bodies.
Yeah, 10 different bodies. And said that what we had in mind, and they said, OK, chaps, go ahead. Yeah. And so the two of us set out to make a long-distance footpath.
Was it easier to set it up in Scotland or England?
In England, I was forced, basically, to stick to existing rights of way. But on the ground, you couldn't see them anyway. Yeah. They weren't there. You know, no one had walked them for 30, 40 years. So it meant that I had a lot of work to do on path clearance and what have you. Whereas Roger had large stretches where there was no existing access, so he had to deal with the landowners there. Luckily, in the Scottish borders, there are basically only three of them. The Duke of Buccleuch, the Earls of Lothian, and the Duke of Roxburgh. So get those online, you're all right, you know. Yeah. So that's, he basically got the go-ahead.
How's it been? A little bit of shooting going on in the background. I mean, here you are, those years later. Anecdotally, we've been speaking to quite a few people. It seems a huge success. What's your take on it?
I think it's worked, basically. I mean, the idea was to get bodies on beds. The fact that it's in fact turned into an international pilgrimage route.
So do you feel a bit of a fraud then? Trying to make money out of this and you've put pilgrims on the map.
Yeah, quite, exactly. No, I think it's worked out fine, you know. And the new leaflets come from Scottish Natural Heritage about this south to north trail. The Borders one is out now from Kirkyetham to Carlops. And there is St Cuthbert's Way, one of Scotland's great walks. Great trails.
I thought, that must have given you a real sense of pride.
Yeah, almost as much when I was driving over to Melrose one day and saw my first waymark by the side of the road. And I thought, good God, it's happened! Right, we're climbing up onto Greensheen Hill. And this is one of the high points of St Cuthbert's Way when you're walking from Melrose to Lindisfarne. Because you go through that gate ahead.
Yeah, we were trying to find out what it was, and you wouldn't tell us. You said it's a surprise.
It is very much a surprise, an unexpected surprise.
Are you excited?
Are you?
Absolutely. I thought the cave was fabulous. This is supposedly better.
The St Cuthbert's Way walker, when they reach this point, know they've almost finished, because we stand up on the ridge, and we are looking down.
Oh, wow, look at that.
Look. Lindisfarne
Castle, at your feet.
Wow,
isn't that beautiful?
That's stunning, isn't it?
There's actually, the ridge we're on, there's another ridge off to our right in front of us, perhaps about half a mile. And then after that, all you can see is the sea and the promontory and the castle at the end of it.
It's quite exciting. I've always wanted to go to Holy Isle. I've never done it. And, you know, that whole magic of the causeway and the tide blocking it off. I'm really quite excited and looking forward to it. I don't know, is the magic wear off for you, is it just me?
Oh, no, it's always. It's always a magic place.
It's quite magical just seeing it there. I don't know how far away that is, 5 miles or so, 6 miles. Yes. And no other long-distance walk's got that. It's pretty special.
You know, the highlights on the walk always are about getting onto a ridge and seeing what's coming next. It is very special, yes.
Giddy excitement creeping in. Well, we left Ron behind at St Cuthbert's Cave, and having had a glimpse there of Lindisfarne and Holy Isle, and we cycled up and over the hill, and we're now within sight of the sea. And I've been across to Holy Isle before, and I took the causeway, and I'm blown if I can see where it is now.
Yeah, we've got about 5 miles to go, coming down some lovely leafy pathways and lanes. It's very like Devon and Cornwall, real famous five adventure stuff. Ian of Blight would have loved this. A wee hiccup to get across here,
And we're just crossing the A1 at the moment.
Very quickly.
Very quickly.
I'm alive!
Ray.
Heading past the Lindisfarne Inn.
I have to say, cycling this route has actually been a revelation to me. There's whole areas of the borders I don't know terribly well. But actually, it's been very safe all the way through. We've seen very little traffic.
Yeah, we've had a couple of times we've been on main roads, but in general, I mean, it's been pretty quiet lanes. Folk are really, really considerate.
Well, we can now see the island very clearly across there to our right. But still not entirely certain about the causeway. It's a falling tide at the moment, according to the guidebook. And we're to meet up with a vicar on the island, Paul. Hopefully he'll be able to fill in some of the gaps on St Cuthbert we haven't got already.
Some of the gaps?
Some of the gaps, well,
vast swages.
Well,
oh, you know, we started whinging this morning, but the one thing St Cuthbert was famous for was being able to change the direction of the wind. And it is now behind us.
Thank you, St Cuthbert.
Okay, here we are at the causeway. Look for tide timetables. You are responsible for your own safety while crossing this. Mark's just ahead of me. Just coming up beside him. Flat calm sea, which has got to be a good thing.
Flat calm sea, but the causeway itself is not actually uncovered yet. So there's a queue of cars in front of us.
Oh, look at the curlew, just taken off to the right.
That's the symbol of Northumbria National Park. But I was just looking at this. I wonder if we could get a jump in these cars.
Well, let's get a wee bit closer.
We'll have a wee shifty and see. We could be very satisfying if we were to wade it.
You know, I think we could get through that.
Yeah, right.
If you go fast enough.
Ah, yes, the old pothole theory.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Okay.
Let's go to the front of this queue and have a look.
A lot of people looking at it.
Yeah.
Looking very nervous.
Of course. And rightly so.
How deep can it be?
How difficult could it be? That's the motto of this programme, basically. Yeah.
Listen, we can do it.
If we come off here, we're stuck. Well, you do see, Mark, like a big kid cycling through puddles. Goodness me, that's deep. That's past my pedals now. First the cross. Of course, we've uncorked the genie now, because all the cars behind us have seen that we can do it. So they think they can do it. Oh, goodness me, that was satisfying. The tide's still rushing underneath this causeway, but I think we're past the worst of it.
Having firmly established ourselves as the hero of the causeway. Look at that crawling through.
Hannibal led them over the mountains.
Actually, there's still quite a tide flowing. There's a section, there's a wee, like, sort of watchtower halfway along. You just go up some steps to sort of keep an eye on what's actually happening in the causeway. But the water's flowing under there at quite some speed.
How satisfying
that
is
was
that?
Great! I was so chuffed.
Child.
Yep. I'm not ashamed of it.
Standing here on the beach in Holy Island, and the air is just alive with waders and the cries of waders, and there was a seal singing earlier. And met up with the vicar on Holy Island, the Reverend Dr. Paul Collins. Why is this such a special place?
I think the reality of any island is that it's a special place. So it's an adventure. I think that's the first thing. You come across the causeway and it feels like an adventure. And you get here and, of course, it's remarkably beautiful. The colours are always changing, the light's changing. It's a great sense of the beauty of nature and creation. Mm.
That wee island just across from us there, just there, I mean, when I say island, it's practically a skerry. What is that? Because it's got a cross on it.
Yeah, that's called St Cuthbert's Island. And we think that Cuthbert and the other monks would go there, stay there while the tide was shut, to be alone and to pray and to be, you know, just with God.
But we were looking out into oyster catchers. There's eider duck there, we've got seals we heard earlier on.
He was a man who got out and got one with nature, didn't he? He used to sneak out at night as well, didn't he?
Yeah, there's a story of him at Coldingham going and praying out up to his neck in the water. And then the story goes that when he comes out of the sea in the morning, the otters come and breathe on his feet to dry them, and then they rub against him to dry him.
I've been surfing at Coldingham. He was tougher than me if he spent all night in the water praying, I'm telling you. It's extraordinary. Do you still get lots of people coming here on genuine pilgrimage?
Oh, yes, there are lots of people, and you see them often. There are the poles across the sand, and people walk across there more or less every day. Hundreds of people come at Easter on pilgrimage. But daily there are pilgrims who will be making their way, often from Melrose.
Can I ask a really crass question? Why?
Well, of course, it has an immense history for Christians, going back to St Aidan, who came from Iona in 635, who founded the monastery here that eventually Cuthbert becomes prior of and then bishop of.
We were talking earlier about long-distance routes as being essentially an excuse to get out and spend time in nature. I wonder, for some people nowadays, not all, I wonder for some people, that's what pilgrimage is too.
I think it is. I think there are all sorts of ways of understanding journey and pilgrimage, and lots of people are making a kind of secular pilgrimage. Mm-hmm. But it is to this beautiful destination.
Should we head up to the church?
And there's also something quite special about the rocks here, isn't there? It's quite complicated, isn't it?
Yeah, the rocks here...
Well, I should be letting you ask that, because you're
the
geologist.
You crack on.
The main rock is Winsill, and that, I understand, has no fossils. And that's also like the stone on Iona.
And why was it important that the rock had no fossils?
Well, I think the early Christians thought that the rock that had no fossils was the pristine rock that God created, and the rock later on that has fossils was after the flood, and so was secondary. So monks often chose, and I think pre-Christian spiritual people chose, the pristine rock because it spoke of paradise.
Yeah. I hear that seal singing again. It's difficult for us in the 21st century too to look at this, because we look at an island and you think, well, it's pretty tough on an island. But they had fish, they had seabirds, they had eggs. There was all sorts of things that you could actually eat. I mean, there was pretty much of a nature's bounty. It may actually have been better than being in many places inland.
I also think that from fairly early on, the beaches round here and possibly the island were marketplaces. So the people came to trade. So there would be the exchange of animals and fish and so on.
So we're coming round. We've got a first glimpse of the castle, which is truly impressive as well. And can we go into the church?
Yes, by all means.
And this is one of the older bits of the whole operation.
It is, yes. Inside St Mary's is the oldest human structure, which is a Saxon structure.
The first thing that struck me was this carving here. Is it wood?
It's wood, it's elm, and it's by a local artist from Durham, Fenwick Lawson, and he intends it, it's sort of site-specific to be there. And then there's another one in cast bronze in Durham, so there's one at the beginning and the end of the journey.
Well, it says that what it is it's six monks, presumably carrying the body of St Cuthbert.
It is.
These monks are about 6'3". It's not quite heroic scale, you know, 1.5 times human scale, but it's really very, very impressive.
It's quite powerful, isn't it? You see it every day, but I mean, wow.
I think when you first come in and you don't know it's there, it certainly takes you by surprise.
Yeah. How special do you think St Cuthbert was?
He was venerated for centuries, probably still is, in a sense, still venerated. But in the Middle Ages, he was the person that people wanted to venerate in the north of this land. Yeah.
You can't help but wonder if the existence of a national nature reserve here is entirely accidental. St Cuthbert was obviously known for his sort of close association with the birds of the air and the beasts of the field and so on, but I mean, just looking out here from Holy Island, there's eider ducks across there, there's a grey heron just at the end of St Cuthbert's Island, there are oyster catchers, there's all sorts of waders, there's curlew about, what would that be, about 400 metres out?
Less than that, I would say about 150, 200 metres out, there's about, I don't know, 100 seals. And you can see them splashing about in the shallows, and every now and again, when the wind calms down, you get that mournful call coming in.
Yeah.
And looking over, you know, we started a bit of cloud there now, but way over those Melrose. And, you know, it's great. There's so many different things. You're pounding up the Eildon Hills. It's hard work, but it's great. And then a bit on the roads, through country lanes. And then for me, there's that transformational moment when you cross over the causeway and just enter another world. I mean, it's not only a spiritual home for many people, but this is wildlife heaven.
Yeah. Whatever your justification for doing it, I could, hand on heart, thoroughly recommend this. As long distance routes goes, 62 miles, it's not huge. Very, very manageable.
If we can do it.
Well, that's the principle on this entire programme's based on. If we can do it, MD can do it. Thanks very much for listening.